Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa. Read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. Success is the culmination of hard work and thorough preparation. But why do crowds get out of control? Buttercup would not let the question drop. You say that football crowds get out of control. Well, we know that is so, but why do they? How do they? What mechanism is employed? The old man gave a sigh because he wanted to discuss something quite different. But a question is a question, and there may be many people who are interested in why, how, etc. Every person has a magnetic field around him. Oh yes, naturally we include her in that. And sad to relate, all too frequently, the magnetic field around the female of the species is stronger than that of the male. Possibly that is why the female of the species is supposed to be dangerous. Everyone, then, has a magnetic field around the body. This magnetic field is not the aura, it is the etheric, and if you find it difficult to visualize, think that instead of a collection of people, you have a collection of bar magnets. Naturally enough, they will be standing on end the same as people do. So let us say, the north points up and the south points down. Well, immediately, you have a lot of magnets with their fields interacting. Some are stronger, some are weaker, some are perhaps a bit warped. And together, they build up quite a formidable force, and they have a strong effect upon nearby structures. In a very similar way, humans, with their built-in magnets, interact upon each other. Some of the magnetic fields are disturbing fields, rather opposed to others, and they will create a ripple of discontent, which can grow and affect people who are normally quite sensible and stable. In a football crowd, everyone is thinking more or less about the same thing, that is, about the game. Yes, we know that perhaps half the crowd want one side to win, and the other half wants the other side to win, but we can disregard that, because they're both thinking of substantially the same thing, a win. So, all the time the game is in progress, the magnetic field is being increased and increased and increased again by the positive thoughts of a win. When some player does something wrong, one side is overjoyed and gets a surge of power, while the other side is despondent and has a reverse of power, which, again, causes a discordant note in what one might term the basic frequency of humans. Under certain conditions, mass hysteria is generated. People who are normally quite decent and well-behaved lose control of themselves and do things of which they are heartily ashamed afterwards. You know that everyone has a built-in sensor, that little inner voice which keeps us on the straight and narrow path. And when mass hysteria occurs, the kundalini of people is affected, and the reverse current, note carefully that it is a reverse current, surges along the spinal column, overpowering the good impulses of the kundalini and overpowering and temporarily paralyzing the human built-in sensor. With the sensor overpowered, there is no limit to the destruction, to the vandalism, and to the outright savagery of which a human is capable. Every fresh act seems to lend power. People become oblivious to hurts they receive themselves, They get bruises, cuts, and assorted gashes in the melee, and they do not notice them. The weaker people fall to the ground and are trampled on. Panic sets in, and the whole mass of people will charge the exits or barricades and, by sheer weight of numbers, will crash through, leaving many injured behind them. When the crowd disperses, the magnetic buildup fails and dissipates, and so people come to their senses. Those who can get away to their homes have time to feel heartily ashamed of themselves at home, whereas those who are carted off in a Black Mariah or paddy wagon cool off in what the police inelegantly term the cooler. The cooler, of course, is a cell where hot tempers soon subside. Oh yes, of course, on a lesser degree, such things can occur with groups and cult meetings. You can get much the same sort of thing when a whole horde of people get together and imagine they are meditating. But they are not. They are building up quite a reversed current, which does more harm than good. Ladies and gentlemen, those of good intention, those who try to do good for others, your attention, please, for something which is of vital importance to sufferers. Do you ever try to do so-called absent healing? Do you ever dash off a bunch of prayers for those who are afflicted? Do you think you're doing a lot of good helping to cure and all of that? As a victim of such very well-intentioned efforts, I want to utter a shriek of protest on behalf of the sufferers. Supposing one has 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 people all wanting to do absent healing onto one poor sufferer. These 3, 4, 5, or 6 people may have absolutely the purest intentions, but they do not know the exact nature of the illness afflicting a sufferer. They try to cast a blanket cure, and believe me, I have definitely been injured by so-called blanket coverage. It is very, very dangerous to hypnotize a person into believing that he has no illness, when, in fact, he's almost dying from some complaint. It is equally dangerous to do this absent healing stuff unless you are a qualified doctor and know the nature of disease and what side effects there can be from that disease. Again, we have our old friend, or more likely old enemy, the law of reversed effort, with which to contend. Under certain conditions, if one too ardently desires a thing, and one concentrates untrained thoughts on a certain thing, then instead of getting a positive thing, a positive result, one gets a negative result. When you get 5 or 6 people all doing the same thing, the suffering of the victim, well, I've had some. My strong recommendation, based on the unfortunate personal experience, is that none of you try absent healing without knowing the precise nature of the complaint, without knowing what side effects might be expected, without knowing the severity of the complaint. Have you ever been in a really populated area and tried to get a radio program, and there seemed to be stations coming in from everywhere, each interfering with the others, so the result was nothing but jangled cacophony, with nothing clear in the whole bunch? That's what you get with absent healing. I do a lot of shortwave listening. It's about my only entertainment now. and sometimes a station will be jammed by Russia or China, and the whining and wailing and the weirdy woos make one have to switch off in a hurry. Unfortunately, it's not so easy to switch off when a group of people are trying, ill-advisedly, and in conflict with each other, to do absent hailing. Mind you, the people concerned can have the highest motives, but unless they are trained as priests or medical practitioners, it's a thing which cannot be recommended. The other day, a taxi driver asked Buttercup a question. He said, "Don't you agree that young people today are far more alert and far more intelligent than were their fathers?" Buttercup had her own comments about that, and probably they were the same as the comments I make. Do I think that young people of today are more aware than their parents were at a similar age? No, by golly, I don't. I think they're a lot dimmer. I think some of them nowadays are just a gang of exhibitionists going about with their long hair and their scruffy, tattered rags of clothing, and the stench which comes from them is enough to lift one's hat off. Not only that, but so many of them appear to be downright stupid. A few years ago, when parents, or no, let's go farther back, when grandparents were teenagers, they had to work. They had to study. They couldn't go watching TV all the time or blaring hi-fi. They had to do things. They had to make their own entertainments. It taught them to think. Nowadays, young people do not seem to be able to make themselves understood in what should be their own language. They are illiterate, downright crummy, in fact. There are some children nearby of school age, and their command of English is not a command at all, it's a complete disorder. They seem to be as illiterate as Hottentots who don't even know what school is. Personally, I think children and teenagers are going like this because both parents go out to work and ignore the absolutely essential requirement that the rising generation shall be taught by the generation whom they are replacing. I think, too, that television and the cinema are largely to blame for the illiteracy and the general mental sluggishness of the average teenager. The films, the television shows, well, they show an absolutely artificial world, an absolutely artificial set of conditions. They show wonderful houses, wonderful estates, and fantastically expensive furnishings, and the film stars seem to have fleets of Cadillacs and hordes of boyfriends or girlfriends. Immorality is not merely condoned, it's actually encouraged. Actress Dinah Dogsbody, for instance, boasts of how many men she has run through and left weak-kneed and shaking, while actor Hector Hogwash boasts of having perhaps 14 wives, presumably divorcing them one after the other. But anyway, what is the difference between prostitution and these actors and actresses who change partners almost at the drop of a, well, the drop of a hat? I was going to say something different, but perhaps there are ladies reading this. My answer, then, is that I think the general standard of education is falling rapidly. I think the education in Europe is far, far higher than it is in the USA and Canada. But then, in Europe, there is still some semblance of parental discipline. Nowadays, mere children can do a menial sort of job, work short hours and get enough money to run wild, to buy all sorts of expensive radios, to buy a car and almost anything they set their mind to. If they do not have the cash, then they soon get a credit account, and they are hooked for life just as surely as if they were on drugs. What is the point of giving people education when the major part of that education seems to be teaching them they should have things which they have no possible chance of obtaining? I think there should be a return to religious discipline, not necessarily Christian, and not necessarily Buddhist, not necessarily Jewish, but a return to some religion, because until the world has some spiritual discipline, then the world will continue to turn out worse and worse specimens of humanity. Quite a number of young people write to me and tell me I'm an old fuddy-duddy because I do not approve of drugs. Now, these young people, 16, 17, or 18 years of age, they think they know it all. They think the whole fount of knowledge is open to them instead of realizing that they have hardly started to live, instead of realizing that they are hardly out of the egg. I am definitely, utterly, and irrevocably opposed to drugs of any kind, unless they are administered according to strict medical supervision. If a person goes and chucks a dollop of acid in the face of another person, then the results are apparent. The flesh peels away, the eyes burn out, acid scores deep grooves in the chin and runs down to the chest, and the result is generally horrible. But that is a kindly act compared to what happens when people become drug addicts. Drugs wrongly used, and all drugs used without medical supervision are wrongly used, can sear the astral body, just as acid can sear the physical body. A drug addict who dies and passes over to the astral world has a truly horrible time. He has to go to what is in effect an astral mental hospital, because his astral body is warped and distorted, and it may take a long time before the most skilled attention that he can receive can restore that astral body to anything like a workable condition. People rave about this entirely evil drug LSD. Think of the number of suicides there have been, the ones that are reported, and think of the ones that have not been reported. Think of the harm that has been caused in terms of insanity and violence. LSD, marijuana, heroin, all those things, they are all devilishly evil. Unfortunately, young people do not seem to be able to accept the advice of older people, people who have the experience. It is true that, for example, LSD will get the astral body separated from the physical body. But all too often, unfortunately, the astral body goes down to one of the lower hells, one of the weirdly astral planes, and when it comes back, the subconscious itself is seared with the horrors it has undergone. So, young people who should be reading this, stay away from drugs. Never mind if you do think drug X or drug Y is harmless. If they are taken without medical supervision, you might have some idiosyncrasy which will make you particularly susceptible to those drugs, and very quickly you will be hooked beyond hope of recovery. Remember, all these drugs are harmful, and although by some remote chance it might now show on your physical for the time being, yet it will show very definitely upon your astral and on your aura. By the way, if people do take drugs and they damage their astral bodies, then they come under the same category as do suicides. And if a person commits suicide, then he or she has to come back to this earth to finish his or her sentence, which is one way of looking at it, or to complete his or her lessons, which is another way of looking at it. Whichever way you look at it, there are no dropouts from the heavenly fields, and no dropouts from this earth either. If you gum up the works this time and do not learn the things which you came here to learn, then you come back and back and back again until you do learn your lessons. So this drug business is a very serious thing indeed, and no action taken by the government can be in any way too severe to deal with the drug problem. The best way to deal with it is for each and every one of us to decide that we will not take drugs. In that way, we shall not be spiritual suicides, and we shall not have to come back to this earth into steadily worsening conditions. In the last paragraph, I referred to spiritual suicides, repeating the remarks in others of my books about suicides. I receive an amazing number of letters from people who tell me that they are going to commit suicide. Perhaps they've been crossed in love. Perhaps they weren't crossed in love and lived to regret it. But whatever it is, I have been appalled at the number of people who write to me saying that they are going to commit suicide. Let me state once again, as I have stated constantly, suicide is never, never justified. If one commits suicide, one just gets slapped back to this earth to enter class once again. So do not think that you can escape your responsibilities by cutting your throat or slashing your wrists or anything like that. You can't. Some years ago, a boy who was somewhat unstable apparently committed suicide and left a note to say he was going to come back in a few years' time. Well, unfortunately, a copy of one of my books, You Forever, was found near him, and the press really had a Roman holiday. They were delirious with joy. They raked up everything they could think of, and then they called in other people to see if they could think of anything else. And you know, the most amazing thing of it all was, it was reported in the press that I encourage suicide. Actually, I have never encouraged suicide. I often think I would like to murder press people, but that fate would be far too good for them. Let them go on making their mistakes and let them pay for it after. I personally believe that the majority of press people are subhuman. I personally believe that the press is the most evil force on this earth today, because the press distorts things and tries to whip up excitement or frenzy, tries to drive people to war. If government leaders could sit down together and discuss matters without the press blaring out a collection of lies and ruining friendly relations, then we should have more peace. Yes, emphatically, based on my own experiences, I am firmly of the belief that the press is the most evil force on this world today. I mention all this because even the press reported that the boy thought he would come back and start again. Well, that was right. The boy would have to come back again. But let me again repeat, I never, never encourage suicide. As I have stated unchangingly for the whole of my life, suicide is never justified. And while some Buddhists apparently do it in the belief that it is going to help the Buddhist cause or the cause of peace, I still maintain that suicide is never justified. So my strong recommendation is, do not even contemplate suicide. It doesn't help. You will have to come back under worse conditions. And if you stick it out here, nearly always, it's not so bad as one fears. The worst things of all never happen, you know. We only think they might. Suicides, dead bodies, etc., etc. Now here is a question which came only yesterday. A lady asks, the cloud which stays over a body for 3 days, is it the soul or the astral body? Doesn't the soul leave soon for the other side? Well, yes, of course. The soul leaves the body with the cutting of the silver cord, just the same as a child is entirely detached from its mother's body as the umbilical cord is detached. Until that umbilical cord is severed, then the child is in coexistence with its mother. In the same way, until the silver cord is disconnected, the astral body is coexistent with the physical body. The cloud, which hangs over a dead body for 3 days or so, is just the accrued energy dissipating. Look at it in another way. Suppose you have a cup of tea. The tea is poured out, and before you can drink it, you're called away. The tea stays hot, but becomes cooler and cooler and cooler. So in the same way, until the body has lost all the energy built up during the lifetime, a cloud hovers over the body, gradually dispersing over 3 days. Another illustration. Suppose you have a coin in your hot little hand, and you suddenly put down that coin. The energy imparted in the form of heat from your hot little hand doesn't suddenly disperse. It takes a certain amount of time for the heat put in the coin by your hand to go, and for the coin to return to the ordinary temperature surrounding it. In the same way, an astral body can be quite detached from the physical body, but by the principle of magnetic attraction, it can still sense the charge around the physical body, and so until all that charge has gone, it is said that the physical body and the astral body are connected. One of the horrors of dying in this part of the world is the barbaric practice over here in North America of embalming people. It seems to me to be much the same as stuffing chickens or something. So in my own case, I'm going to be cremated, as that is far better than to be handled and messed around by the embalmer and his mate. And, as a certain lady cat said, "The old man is trying to complete feeding the flame before he feeds the flame." May I, for my part, say that I hope they will not put on the crematorium door when I'm inside, frying tonight. A lady, I am sure she is a lady because she writes in such an elegant manner, takes me to task somewhat. "Why do you occultists always say this is so and that is so, but offer no proof? People must have proof. Why do you never give proof? Why should we believe anything? God has never said a word to me, and the astronauts have not seen any sign of heaven in space." Proof. That's one of the biggest things. But tell me this. If one is a sighted person in the country of the blind, how does one give proof that there is sight? Moreover, how do you give proof when so many people will not believe a thing when it's stuck slap in front of their nose? There have been many very eminent scientists, and I can only think of Sir Oliver Lodge for the moment. Quite a number of famous names have been interested in proof, in science, cooperating with the occult world. For example, Sir Oliver Lodge, a most spiritual man, addressed a very important association in 1913 in England. Sir Oliver said, "Either we are immortal beings, or we are not. We may not know our destiny, but we must have a destiny of some sort. Science may not be able to reveal human destiny, but it certainly should not obscure it." He went on to say that in his opinion, the present-day methods of science would not work in securing proof. He said also that it was his belief that if reputable scientists were allowed to work free without all the scoffers and doubters, then they could reduce occult occurrences to physical laws, and that is obviously very much so. People who demand proof in the terms of bricks standing upon bricks. They want proof, while all the time they are trying to prevent that proof. People who go into occult studies just trying to get a material proof are like people who go into a dark room, turn on the lights to see if there's any image on the yet undeveloped film. Their actions definitely inhibit any manifestation of proof. In the occult world, we are dealing with intangible matters. We are dealing with matters of an extremely high vibration. And the way people go along nowadays is something like using a pneumatic road drill to excavate in order that fillings may be put in one's teeth. Before proof can be given in a materialistic sense, scientists have to be trained in what can be and what cannot be. It's useless for them to charge like a bull at a gate. They're not breaking bricks. They're trying to find out something which is as basic as humanity itself. If people will be honest with themselves, if they will stay away from the television screens and the cinemas and all that stuff, and if they will meditate properly, then they will have an inner awareness that such a thing is. They will become aware of their own spiritual natures, always assuming that their spiritual nature is not so debased as to preclude any other manifestation. For years, in addition to wanting to photograph the aura which I see around every person I have wanted to develop, as I've already stated, a telephone which would enable the ordinary people, non-clairvoyant, non-clairaudient people, to telephone the other side. Think what fun it would be looking up a heavenly telephone directory and having to ask for information. Did he go up or down? I suppose the nether regions would have an exchange called Brimstone, or something similar. Anyway, in years to come, when scientists are less materialistic, then it will be that there will be such a telephone. Actually, there has been, but that's another story. Perhaps I should head the next bit, Stop Press News, because there has been a telephone call from John Henderson, some 3,000 miles away. He has now had some proof of people on the other side of this life. A message came to him, and he had the sensation that he was having his head kicked in, which is what I once told him I'd like to do to him. But anyway, he just phoned to say that at last he has got the message. That message was directed from the other side and not at all impelled by me. Someday perhaps John Henderson may write a book. He should. And if he tells about this occurrence, many people will probably say, "Well, I never. I wouldn't like such things to happen to me." "Hi, Gov," said Miss Taddy, jerking to a full awake after being soundly and noisily asleep for some time. "I've got a question which any human would like answered." "All right, Taddykins, what is it?" So Miss Taddykins sat down and folded her arms and said, "Well, it's like this. We cats know what arrangements are made on the other side, but why don't you tell humans how they plan their life on Earth?" Personally, I thought I had dealt with that ad nauseam, and I don't want Buttercup to come jumping at me telling me that I am repeating myself. And after writing so much about suicide, it might be something akin to suicide if I start up again writing about life after death. So perhaps I can get over that by calling this answer Life Before Birth. On the other side of this life, an entity has decided that he or she must go to school again to take a special course. Perhaps certain lessons were learned previously, and the return home has enabled those lessons to be digested and weaknesses to be perceived. So then, the entity who is he or she sits down and thinks things over. On Earth, many students discuss their future with a counselor. They discuss what courses are required in order that they shall obtain a certain qualification. For example, a nurse in England wants to become a surgeon. Obviously, she has some knowledge of anatomy, so what does she need in order to enter medical school? She discusses what she has to do and then goes to it. In the same way, our he or she on the other side of life, on Earth, decides, with considerable help, what lessons have to be learned, what tasks have to be surmounted, and what difficulties have to be endured. And then the whole thing is planned very carefully. Do you play chess? Well, if you do, you'll know all about those chess problems which appear in certain magazines. The chessboard is all set up with pawns and knights and rooks and all that in certain predetermined positions. You, poor soul, have to think and think until your brain nearly cracks and work out a way in which to win that game. It's something like that in planning the life to come. All the obstacles are set up. All the conditions are laid down. What do you have to learn? Do you have to learn poverty and how to overcome it? It's no good going to a rich family, then, is it? Do you have to learn how to be generous to others, how to handle money? Then it's no good going to a poor family, is it? You have to decide what you want to learn. You have to decide what sort of family will best meet your requirements. Are you coming to a tradesman's family or to a professional family? Or are you coming as one of a noble family? It all depends, you know. It's like actors on a stage. An actor may be a king in one play and a beggar in another. And it's just the same with life. It depends on what you have to learn. You come to the station, to the conditions, to the difficulties, to the problems and obstacles which you yourself have decided upon. Before you come, you set up your problems in very much the same manner as a chess problem is set up and then left for someone else to solve. So you have your problems set up in front of you, and instead of just sitting down and scratching your head and anywhere else which is troubling you at that moment and trying to work it out, you do something about it. You look about and find the family, the country, the locality, which will best enable you to live the problems which you have chosen and solve them by the mere act of your living and enduring the difficulties and the tests. After all, a student perhaps going to a postgraduate course, he knows he's going to have some hardships. He knows he has to get a certain percentage of marks, otherwise he won't pass. Otherwise he's got to come back again. He knows that he'll have to serve a certain time in the classrooms. But he knows all these things and he wants to go through with it because he wants the qualifications or the knowledge that comes after. So you planned everything, but none of your plans ever included suicide. If you commit suicide, then it means you're a dropout. It means you failed. And if a person is a dropout, it means he can't advance through lack of qualification and through lack of intestinal fortitude. Always, without any exception, those who drop out of life through suicide come back and start all over again with a fresh bunch of problems just tagged on for luck. Next time you look in some newspaper or in some magazine and you see a chess problem all set up so nicely on the black and white squares of print, well, just remember you set up the problems like that for yourself before you came to this earth. How are you solving them? Are you making out all right? Don't be disheartened. You started it, you know. End of chapter 4.